last question is the most interesting to me. But as for where I'm from, so I was raised in Rochester, New York. It's a town on Lake Ontario, about an hour east of Buffalo, New York. And yeah, my dad left my mom when I was about a one and a half. And that's actually my earliest memory that I can have, which is, I guess, is strange, but not unheard of for someone to remember something that young. But I do, like, I remember where I was sitting in the house as my dad walked out the door, and we had moved from that apartment like months later. So it's not like I grew up in that apartment. And so when I described the layout of the apartment, my mom was like, yeah, that's right. That's exactly what that place was like. And so I was like, yeah, that's my earliest memory. And so it was my mom, my sister, and I growing up. Yeah, it was, you know, looking back on it and talking to my mom about it, it was tough for her. But as a child, you know, you don't know any better. You just think this is the way life is. You know, we were pretty poor. Like, I just remember spending time like with my mom waiting in different, like in the Social Security office or, in the benefits office, or going with her to wait in line in a food pantry to pick up food. And
but was all normal to you, though. That wasn't unusual or
right. That just kind of seemed that's what I did, and so everyone else must be doing the same thing too. They just be coming on different days, maybe. Yeah, it was pretty normal. We grew up in a church community, and they were that was actually really helpful for my mom and my sister and I, just having a larger community of people that would also help and yeah, a lot of them were lower middle class as well. And so it's not like we were outside the norm of where we're in terms of poverty wise. I think some of the more defining things of my childhood, we'll put a pin in that for now. Because you asked a question like, how would they describe me when I was young? I think they would describe me as I was pretty happy. I think I was kind. That was something that my mom talked about. And yeah, it's pretty carefree.
Was it a diverse town where you grew up in?
It was not. I lived in the city of Rochester. And actually, let's check that. Was it because we lived in the city. So I had, like, people in our church were Latino, African American, and white, but majority white. So it was actually pretty diverse now that I think about it. Like, my friends growing up was a it's people from different races, but so actually interestingly diverse in terms of race, but yeah, in terms of socioeconomic status, we were all pretty much in the same kind of tier.
Gotcha.
So I ended up going to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And that is a long, long story how I got there.
Tell us, what's the story?
I guess there are several different kind of factors that went into me kind of ending up there, now that I think about it. One of the big ones was grew up, so when we were poor, my mom was on, public assistance. But when my sister was about 3 years older than me, so she went to elementary school. And then when I started first grade, I think, my mom went to the local community college to get a degree in accounting.
Oh, wow.
And so she fought really hard to work her way off of public assistance. And it's really interesting. If you were to talk to her, she'd tell you stories about how some social workers were just like, just have some more kids. That way you can stay on longer. And fortunately for her, she didn't take that advice. And so she took a couple of years, but she got her associate's degree while we were in elementary school and got a job as a bookkeeper and worked her way off public assistance. So by the time I was in fifth grade, we were off of public assistance. We still, I mean, money was tight still, but I think it was better for us. And that's kind of one of the defining features in my life as well, shaping me and how I look at the world, is just seeing my mom's own determination in light of everything going against her, that she still wanted to work and improve her life and improve the life of her kids. And then in sixth grade, it was fifth or sixth grade, my dad came back into my life. My mom had found his number in a phone book at work. So my mom asked me if I wanted to meet my dad and if I wanted her to call, and she did. And my stepmom answered, and that's when I first found out that my dad had remarried. But then, my dad and I reconnected, and he started, kind of being integrated back into my life and me back into his. And so that was in kind of the end of elementary school, beginning of junior high. And I got reconnected with my dad's family. And that's one of the pieces of how I ended up in North Carolina, was because my grandfather on my dad's side went to graduate school at the University of North Carolina and ended up going from there, moved up to Rochester to work for a company called Kodak, which used to be a big deal back when all cameras were on film and Kodak was dominating the market. And so Rochester was actually the headquarters of Kodak. And anyway, so my dad was raised to be a North Carolina basketball fan, and really all my dad's siblings and my cousins. So that's how I first got introduced to the propaganda for University of North Carolina. So that was one of the pieces. I don't think I would have ended up at Carrot, North Carolina if I hadn't been connected with my dad. When I was in ninth grade, just a few years after I met my dad, I was visiting a friend on winter break in a small town called Canandaigua. It's in the Finger Lakes region of New York. But it was a friend's house that I'd visit often. And so I was there as normal. And one morning we woke up and we're like, let's go see this old railroad bridge that's near his house. There's this kind of old railroad track that ran in the woods behind my friend's house. And, it had never been used as long as I've been alive. And the city of New York was starting to break it down. And they're, from what I recall, they're trying to turn all these old railroad tracks into trails, so like kind of nature trails. And so a little bit down the track was where the bridge used to go over a local highway. So like it's called a highway, but it's a two-lane road. So the state was in the process of removing the bridge from there. So the bridge was gone, but the walls were up on either side of the highway. And my friend and I, there was no one on site. It was middle of winter. And so we walked, the fences were kind of falling down. We walked over them kind of around a car barrier. And then we tried to get as close as we could to the edge. And I tried to step down on the part of the ledge where the bridge used to rest right before, the concrete embankment would end. And, as I was stepping down, I was stepping down kind of backwards, you know, like holding onto the ground and stepping down onto the ledge. And so I didn't see where I put my foot. And so one foot went down and the other one missed the ledge. And the one that was on the ledge was on a bunch of loose gravel that I didn't know was there. So it just, the one that was on the ledge slipped off. And so I fell backwards off the edge of the concrete embankment. It was like 15 feet. And so just the way I fell, I was able to kind of like grab on to the ledge, but I wasn't able to like hold it. So I remember like scraping all my hands on the way down, but I landed on my feet. But because of the surprise, like my knees were locked. And so in that process, just one of my vertebrae was shattered. A couple other were damaged. And so I fell over on the side of the road, and it took me a second for me to like try to get up. And then I realized that my legs weren't working and I couldn't walk. And so friend came down, some motorist stopped that he'd seen. I don't know if he had seen me fall, but he had seen me on the side of the road. And so he called 911. And so the rest of my high school career was spent trying to relearn everything. Like I spent the next 2 months in the hospital. I had emergency surgery to kind of stabilize my back, and then I was in the hospital for 2 months, just going through therapy to try to physical therapy, occupational therapy, to see how much of the use of my limbs I could recover and also learn how to function. And so I, after that, I was confined to a wheelchair.
What was running through your mind once you realized your legs weren't working anymore? I mean, you're 14 by that point, so you're pretty grown. I mean, what's going through your mind?
I think, initially you're just in shock. Like the moment of, you know, I'm just crying, partly because it's scary, partly because the pain was incredible. And then it was kind of a whirlwind, you know, you're kind of moving through the, you know, I was helicoptered over to Rochester, moving through the ER, going through a bunch of tests, talking to doctors, but I'm 14, I don't really understand. But fortunately, you know, my stepmom is a nurse practitioner. And so I was actually at the hospital that she was serving at. And so she was able to visit, and she was actually such a huge resource for me and my dad and my mom as well, just to help understand like and navigate a whole new world. So it was scary and overwhelming. And early on, the doctors, they don't want to tell you that you don't have any chance of recovering. Because if you work hard, you know, what happened was my spinal cord was partially severed as a result of the shattering of the vertebrae. And so, so there were still some nerves that were connected, and so the doctors really didn't know how much I could recover. And it takes years. Like actually today, I have more mobility than I've had since I was injured. Like I can, I have forearm crutches that I can use to get around. I still use a wheelchair for everyday use just because of simplicity and ease. So I guess the point of that is to say the doctors basically say, we don't know how much you can recover, but here's the path to learn how to recover. And so physical therapy. So you're kind of just diving in and saying, okay, I got to do all these exercises that the therapist is telling me to do. And At the same time, I'm, you know, in ninth grade and I'm trying to catch up on schoolwork. And so like a,
did you go back to the same high school?
I did. I had the city of Rochester paid for a tutor to come to the hospital to kind of help me through assignments while I was in the hospital, which was great. And so I did that. So let's see, I was injured. Gosh, it would have been February 21st, 1997. So then I think I was released from the hospital early April and then started back at school in May. I don't know why I finished. I went back to school before the school year finished, but I did. So sometime in May. It was just for a few months because I think the school year ended in June. But yeah, I went back to the same high school. And it was a small, like I said, it was a small Christian school. But the school was really great. They kind of made sure that all my classes were on the same floor. And
how did the students and your friends respond to you coming back in a wheelchair?
Really well. I think that was one of the real blessings of it, is I think they really they really worked to help make the school more accessible for me, like my friends really worked to kind of keep me to be part of the community as much as possible. So like, wow. I didn't get my license until much later in life, driver's license. And so, but I had friends and they would make sure to carry me in my wheelchair around wherever. So I feel like I was really fortunate, to have, people who cared about me and, made me feel included. That was huge. And the other thing is just that, one of the other things that helped me integrate or not integrate, that's not the word. I don't know what the word is. Kind of get me back into normal routine and figure out that life is still livable after such an immense change is I got involved in a wheelchair basketball league. I played basketball before I was injured. I was on the like junior varsity team, and on the varsity team for a year. And I was very bad at basketball. Not very bad. I would ride the pine. I really enjoyed basketball. And so once I kind of had figured out how to use the wheelchair, there's a ton of resources for people who have spinal cord injuries, and one of them is this thing called the National Spinal Cord Injury Institution Association. And then I met people through there, and then I got connected to the wheelchair basketball team. And so I had like a group of friends in high school that made me feel like I was a part of that community, but also had this other community of guys who were in wheelchairs, and a lot of them were much, much older than me. They're in their 30s and 40s at the time. And then myself and two other kids my age applied to join the team at the same time. So we kind of came on as like the junior members, and the older guys took us under their wing. And that was great. It's part of the National Wheelchair Basketball Association. So I like to tell people that I was professional basketball player earlier in my life. We would travel around the Northeast to play teams in Ohio and Pennsylvania. And it was really fun. We'd have overnight trips, and that was just, it was really huge for me. To be like, oh, life goes on, and I could still go and stay in hotels and go out to restaurants and watch my older teammates get completely inebriated at restaurants and make fools of themselves. And I just see that there's that life goes on. And So that was a huge, a part of me learning how to live life, after that injury.
Okay. So I guess joining that league, cause what's happening is like after a really terrible injury like that, where it feels like I'm never gonna have a normal life again, this was your first glimpse into maybe it doesn't have to be this way. And I could have a normal life and experience the things that other people experience as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this was before college.
This was all before college. Yeah.
My gosh. Yeah. I've lived like 20 lives before college.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've had a lot of experience, with some things for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was all before college. And that was, all of that was kind of playing into as I was trying to figure out where I was going to go to college. I think kind of the taste of the bigger world that the basketball team allowed me, made me really want to try to go to school somewhere else in the country where I didn't, where I didn't know what it was like, just kind of see the larger world. And so, I applied, to UNC and, got in, and I went down to visit, and it was very, very warm. It was like in April, and, my dad and stepmom took me down to visit, and, I was wearing sweaters all the way down. And then I got down and it was warm. I was like, this is great. There's no snow. This is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so I, decided to go. And also just wanted a chance to see if I could make it on my own. Cause I was, I think learning how to take care of yourself after you have an injury is just, it's multifaceted, right? It's not just, you can't walk. And so you have to figure out how to get around, but there's like medical conditions and effects that you kind of have to manage. But, and so I was relying on my parents for much of that early on. And so I was like, towards the end, of my high school, like I'd learned how to kind of take care of those medical needs myself. But I also just wanted to see, hey, can I do life on my own? Like, I don't want to, it'd be very easy just to stay at home or stay near home and, just rely on my parents who would be more than happy to help. I wanted to see the larger world, but also kind of see if I had what it takes to make it. And so I think that was part of the desire as well.
Where do you think that even came from? Was it seeing your mom kind of fighting for herself to be self-sufficient? Because I feel like that's such a short period of time to go through all that. And then on, you know, at that point for you to say, I want to see if I can do it. That alone, that desire alone seems like that takes a certain type of person or mindset to even have that desire. Because like you said, you could stay home, be comfortable, be taken care of, and like know things are going to be okay. Yeah. But where did that come from?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's like my wife Esther and I, we talk about this a bit of just like how, you know, just how, because there's a lot of other choices I could have made or that other people make, and it might have been a better choice for them. But yeah, I think it was watching my mom to kind of overcome her adversity and thrive and set us up for success. I don't know. It felt like I had a choice, and like there's pathways you can take, and some lead you to stay the same or become smaller, and some will help you grow and become a better person or a stronger person. And I don't know. I think I've always wanted to be the type of person that would have the courage to take the hard path. Because it's worth it, for myself, but also for the world, right? Like,
But did you ever have a moment of self-pity or kind of?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think trying to recall, there was tons of self-pity. Like there are just things that, I just missed out on because of my injury. Like I am so fortunate and, like I have a wonderful wife, who loves me dearly and who I love more than anything. But back in high school, like, man, I couldn't, I didn't have any, I think I took people to prom, but I think part of me wondered if they just went with me because they felt pity for me. Like I just didn't feel like I was attractive or desirable. And I couldn't do those things that kind of separated potential mates from others. You know, like I wasn't athletically gifted, like in kind of the classic way, or I couldn't drive a car at that point to pick them up, or, you know, like it was just like I had like a lot of the kind of the normalcies of teenage experience, like where you kind of have, you know, go on dates and meet people at parties and do those sort of things. Like those were kind of taken from me. And so I think I experienced a lot of sadness about missing those. Like, again, I had friends who would take me to concerts and do things like that. So I feel like I had a measure of it, but kind of the ability to make choices and be independent. I missed out on some of that. And so I think part of that was what motivated me to go to North Carolina, was just be like, this is me making an independent choice. Like I can go and I'll figure it out when I'm there. Like I'll live on campus and, I think I think we're all human. Like, I don't think there's people who go through life unaffected, or maybe there are, but I say that to say, like, I think sometimes when I tell my story to people, they just are in awe or be like, I can never do that. And it's like, no, you can. You do it every day. Like, you make the choices every day. Mm-hmm. And those are courageous choices. And some of them seem small. I think some of the things that become interesting about my story is just because the circumstances are abnormal, right? The injury, the paralysis. But it's the thought process and the choice process is the same as, anyone who has to, you know, kind of choose who they want to be and what they want to become and which path they want to take.
Right. And I think that, I mean, you know, irregardless of some of the more extraordinary events that happened in your life, grit to me for you is a consistent characteristic over time. I think by now I've known you maybe 10 years now, and I feel that it's not in, you know, I didn't know you when you were a teenager, but even the time that I've known you, it's kind of like what you said, it's in your day-to-day. You and Esther are one of those few people who go into the hard places, have difficult conversations, or if someone's in a really difficult place, you're there. You guys go through something difficult. You know, there's this element of perseverance there. And And I think you're right. Like, I think we all have that choice, but I think what I would love to kind of unpack more for people listening is in whatever area in your life where you do feel helpless, or I think a lot of us get stuck in that place where you can't make that. I don't know why they can't make that choice for themselves, but it's like trying to understand more of what motivates you, or, you know, how maybe we can encourage other people that they do have the ability to maybe live the life that they want, or not to feel self-pity. Because I think we all feel that for ourselves from time to time, or more often than others. So yeah, I mean, like, how do you do it?
Yeah, I, there's a book by an author, that I know you've heard of. His name's C.S. Lewis, and it's a book called Mere Christianity. And I don't know where all the listeners are in terms of faith. But it's a helpful book, I think, whether or not you want to become a Christian or are a Christian or not. But something he said in there, I think I read it when I was, I read it when I was in high school. And it's kind of stuck with me, has been that we are always, is it there? I think it's there. And I think he expands on it in other essays, but we're always making choices every day to either become something glorious or something incredibly evil. Like, it's kind of, but it's a journey. It's this path. And he's talking about it in terms of how a loving God could send people to hell. And I don't know where I stand on that, but I do think, his point is you're making these choices, small choices every day, and they become easier to make in the same direction. And so if you want to be more courageous, just start being more courageous in little things. Like, I remember when I was in high school, it was so hard for me to like order a pizza. Like, my mom would be like, "Hey, let's order a pizza." And I would like be so scared to like pick up the phone and call. And it was just so weird. Like, yeah. I know it's a normal conversation, but it just seems so intimidating. Like, what if I didn't know what to say? Or like, what if I get it wrong? Or, you know, what if they don't, if I say the address, you know, like there's just, I'd have to make another phone call to someone that I had a crush on or something. Like, but you kind of just sit there and you kind of say, well, what am I going to do? I can choose not to do this, or I can just push the numbers. I can do it. But it's those little choices of saying, hey, I want to do what's right. I want to, and even though it's scary, even though it's hard, I need to take this next step. And it actually has turned out to be true in my life that those small choices every day, or, you know, whenever they pop up, that it's made those bigger choices, I was going to say easier, but not easier. I mean, they were super hard. I'm sure we'll get to some of those choices later on in this conversation, but it made them doable. It made them possible. And I think it's just because of we are always in the process of becoming who we're going to be. And so it's the small things of, like, if you see someone or you're one of your friends in pain and you're also having a bad day, you could ignore them because you're like, you know, I'm having a bad day too. Or you can make the choice of like, no, I'm going to care for them. And then they'll respond. Hopefully they'll respond and help care for me as well. And we can do this together. But to always make the choice to kind of move towards people and to be the one to move first. I think a lot of times we wait for other people or other things to kind of get in line. So it, we like, when that happens, then I can definitely move in. But that's not, that doesn't happen. Like, things don't line up. The stars don't align. Not unless you move first. And so I think, but it's a long, another author kind of talks about it as a long obedience in the same direction. And I think that's right. Like, you know, if you have a vision of what kind of person do you want to be when things are hard, or when life throws things at you that you don't think you can take, like, and then if you have that vision in your mind and say like, well, what does that mean? I have to start learning how to do now.
Do you think that people, what about in those scenarios, you're afraid you'll be forgotten or your pain is not addressed? Because I think, to your example, I'm having a bad day and this person's having a bad day, but what about me? You know, it's that mindset I think a lot of us have.
Yeah, I think there's two angles to take on that. And I think you have to take both of them, because one on by itself is not enough. But the first one is to really learn how to take care of yourself. And that sounds a little pithy, but to recognize, hey, I'm having a bad day. Okay, why am I having a bad day? What am I feeling? Like, how do I need to take care of myself? And knowing that you have the resources, like that you've developed the internal resources to be like, okay, I can, like whether it's meditation or praying or, you know, whatever kind of care practices that you've built into your life, that you, to know that you, like, if you're having a bad day, to be like, okay, I'm having a bad day, but it's not the end of the world. Like, I'm going to be okay. And you know that because you've learned how to take care of yourself. That's part of the picture, is to say, I don't need other people to make sure that I'm okay. Like, it's wonderful if they do. And I think that's the second step, is because when you're confident that you're like, I know what I can do, what it takes to make sure that I'm okay. Or and one of those steps is asking other people for help, but it's having the courage to ask. And it's also having built up the capital and relationships so that when you ask, it's reciprocated. And both of those things take time. But I think a lot of times we just expect other people to take care of us, and we don't realize that at the exact same time they're expecting the same thing. And so then no one's taking care of each other. But if we learn to ask, if we learn how to also have the own internal resources that we can take care of ourselves and also have other people take care of us. It's like this, this mutuality thing. And I think sometimes we look at relationships, well, if I take care of other people, then they'll take care of me. And it's like, no. Like, you can do a lot of things for yourself. Like, and then you can invite other people to help you in those areas that you can't. And depending on where you are in life and how much trauma you're going through at the moment, like, you might need people to do more for you than you can do for yourself in that moment. Right. Like, like when I was injured, like, I needed people to push me around. Like, I don't need that right now. And so I'm not going to ask people to do it for me, but, and so I think, I think having this sense of self-sufficiency, but self-sufficiency is, it's a, to have an accurate portrayal of yourself, be like, I can do this much And for other things, like I need to build a community and lean on that community for those things. And so it's not like this complete self-sufficiency that I don't need other people or don't rely on people. Like, I'm not trying to be an island or a completely isolated, completely self-sufficient person. There's no such thing, but to know that I have the resources because I've developed them over time. And I've made sure. So I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm really glad you made that distinction of being able to take care of yourself and not being an island. Cause I do think that's sort of the misconception of that idea. And do you know Esther Perel, the therapist, relationship, marriage and family therapist? She's awesome. And she writes a lot about like relationships and has podcasts and all this stuff. And she had this article out that we have a misconception of what self-care is. And it's to your point, it's not about being an island. She said, when did we begin to believe that we're able to do everything on our own and we don't need everybody else? But I think I was going to ask you though, for those who don't know that they're going to be okay, what are some ways they can start practicing developing those skills for themselves, that knowing that they can be okay?
Yeah, I think so. In one of my lifetimes, I got a master's degree in counseling, and I remember as part of that, I would study a series of different therapy techniques and just different approaches to just how we grow as human beings. And one of them that was really compelling to me and has stuck with me to this day is this, it's narrative therapy, and there's kind of in different forms, but essentially it's just recognizing that we are at all times telling a story about ourselves and the world, and we're living out that story. And the premise of narrative therapy is to say, let's look at the story that someone is telling about themselves and then help them ask that question, is that true? And if it's not, like, and what if it's not? Because I think a lot of times, for example, if you look at the facts of my story, for example, like there's a way to tell it in which I'm a victim, right? Mm-hmm. And like, I've just had these terrible circumstances happen to me in life. And in some sense that would be true. It could be a very plausible narrative. And you can say, well, this is just life. Life just, you know, you work really hard and then, you know, something comes and just boom, you can't walk. And, I remember even approaching that. I was in college and I was visiting a family member, and a person who lived with that family member was an older woman. She was on Social Security disability at the time. And she just looked at me. She's like, why are you in college? Like, you could just, like, you have a disability. You could just stay on disability and get a check. You don't need to do all that. And that was such a surprising question. I didn't even know how to answer it, because it just was totally against the way that I had understood my life and kind of been moving. But I think that's the narrative coming in. Like, what narratives are you telling myself? Well, I'm disabled. Like, I can't do it. Like, but if you learn to retell that narrative, to say, no, what if that's not the true story about me? And what if I'm different? And the way you do that is not by making stuff up. It's just kind of saying, hey, what are counter narratives to that narrative in this? Because we all have those stories, right? Where, you know, maybe we haven't lived the life that we wanted to, but you can kind of see, like, there's moments where you were that person that you wanted to be. And to say, you know, that time that, you know, I was really sad and depressed, but you know, this friend reached out for help and I was able to just call her and just listen and tell her I love her and bring her some soup or something. You know, like there's like these moments that we all have that are heroic and we just don't recognize them because we're so caught up in telling this negative narrative about ourselves. And so I think for people to be like, if you're sitting here and you're thinking, I don't have the resources, I don't have the internal resources, I'm not enough. I think to say that's not the true story. There are times that you have not felt like you've had enough. That's true. But there are times where you've acted against that you were able to be there for someone, or you're able to overcome an obstacle and you succeeded where you didn't think you would. And to start remembering those moments and start telling that your story with those moments in mind. I think that can be so powerful. Like there was a time when I was in graduate school. So I got a master's in divinity and a master's in counseling. And it wasn't until I was in graduate school that I really started to deal with like the emotional impact and the spiritual impact of like my injury. And I entered a depression and it was really low. And I actually considered taking my own life. And I remember going to a therapist and, he gave me a short story to read, or it's not a story, but it's an essay called A Room Called Remember by, Frederick Buchner. And, but my assignment that week was just to remember. And so I just remember like, I took out all these photographs that I had from my childhood all the way up to the present. And I realized that, and I think this is where the kind of the narrative therapy or the narrative idea took hold in me, is I realized that when I was depressed, all I could think about was really the negative moments in my life. And those are the ones that were kind of springing out to the forefront. But when you look at pictures, right, you often take pictures of the bright moments in your life. And so what I realized was that in my depression, I was missing a large piece of that, of the story. And that was a true part of the story. Like all the really good things and beautiful things that have happened to me that are outside of my control as well. Like the people that were so kind to my mom and my sister and I growing up, or the friends in high school, or the friends in college, or the doctors and the nurses that helped me as I tried to recover after the injury. Like there's just like our lives are shot through with so many like beautiful moments that are sometimes they're us, you know, they're beautiful things that we've done, and to honor those, acknowledge those. And a lot of times it's beautiful things that other people have done, and to honor those, acknowledge that as well. And I think when you start to understand your life, looking both at the shadows and the light, and getting the full picture, you realize that you were okay the whole time. And that helps you when you think about the future to be like, you know, the future is going to be just like that. Like there are going to be some really tragic, hard, terrible moments of shadow, but there are going to be these points of light, these moments, these people, these times where I am better than I ever thought I could be, or kinder, or more good, or people are more kind than I ever thought they would be. And to know that that's just going to happen. And so the mystery becomes less mysterious when you realize this is the world and I made it this far, and I made it because I was strong in these moments. Like, cause if you're here, you made it. And I think that's the thing that, in the middle of when things are low or you're feeling down, like you're like, shoot, I'm not where I want it to be in life. But you're here and you made it, and to kind of honor the things that got you here, and then to move into those and retell your story in a way that, frees you to become more and more the person you want to be.
So I won't go into the details of the situation, but I know that you've recently gone through something very difficult and very challenging. And maybe you can even consider it life-changing. But I'm curious to know, are you able to apply your experience to your future outlook on things?
Yeah, I think on my better days, for sure. I think that's one of the points of it is, it's not like I've become Zen or anything. Like I'm still cynical, and I still have days where I'm just like, I don't understand people, and they're acting crazy, and I'm angry at them. But I think that has given me the ability to weather this better than other people, just because I'm like, this is round three. You know, like for a lot of other people, it's round one, and they're like, oh shit, this is terrible. Mm. And I'm like, yeah, it is really terrible. But yeah, it's like round, I don't know, like when you kind of lose your dad and you like for a time, and like you grow up like in poverty, and then you like become paralyzed, and then you have to kind of rebuild your life after that. It just becomes a little easier to kind of pick up the pieces again. Mm. And yeah, I think a cynical way is to be like, well, if the pieces are going to keep getting knocked down, then why do I keep putting them up again?
Yes. Good question.
And I think there's two answers to that. One is I think that life is a gift. And every minute of life is a gift. Like, there's been a longer period in the universe that we have not existed than when we have existed, like you and me and the people listening to this. Like, and then when we die, we're going to be gone. And whatever happens after death, you know, we don't know for sure right now. And so like, just to say, hey, this, even if I believe that something good and beautiful is going to happen after death, like that doesn't mean that this life isn't good and beautiful and worth living to the full. And so I think that's part of it, is just, your other choice is just to give up on living, and you're going to miss that on so much. Mm. But I think another piece of it is, you know, every time you pick up the pieces and build again, you're going to do that with the knowledge that you learned from the last time. And hopefully that knowledge will make you a better builder and make you build a better life. And, yeah, like I think my injury helped me change what my definition of a successful life would be. Like,
in what way?
You know, like it does. I think, yeah, I'm pausing because I don't know exactly how to articulate it. I don't even know if I really knew it at the time. And I don't know how many ninth graders really have a philosophy of life anyways. So I'm trying to think of how much it changed, but I think one of the things I learned out of it is just, like when I got to do normal things again, like when I was like released from the hospital to go on day trips to go see a movie, where I wasn't surrounded by people and hospital beds and nurses and stuff, like that was part of the occupational therapy. Like they'd send you out to do things. And you learn to see the wonder in every day. And so I don't know. I feel like a successful life is one in which you don't lose that wonder, and you are good and kind towards other people, and you are loved, and other people Yeah. And you love other people. And the thing that's beautiful about defining success in that way is I think that's something that we can all achieve. We can't all be, whatever we're trying to get to. And I think ambition is good, and striving after becoming the best version of yourself that you can is good. But we constantly try to define success in our world as compared to other people. But what that means is that it's a closed pie. Like only some people can have it and then some people can't. But if the definition of success is a life well lived where you love others and others love you and the world is better because you're in it, that's an unlimited pie and we can keep adding to it. And what that means is that my success doesn't have to cause someone else to not be successful. And another person's success doesn't keep me from feeling successful. Like I think, in the latest iteration of my life, I went to law school, and law school can be so competitive because you're like, I'm going to be like, they rank you, like they literally rank you at the end of each year. And you're like, man, there are X number of people in front of me and there are X number of people behind me. And what does that say about me? And the reality is this says absolutely nothing about you, other than how well you did on a test. And that can be as affected by things as, you know, how much sleep you got versus how much you were paying attention in the class where that subject was covered versus the class where the other, you know, other subjects you weren't paying attention to, but you just, that wasn't on the exam. Like there's just all these things that can just, like the measurements we use for success can be distorted, especially when we use them in comparison with other people. But if you let catastrophe shape you in a way that you can learn how to see success and see your life in a different way, and it becomes a better world for you and for the people around you. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I like that. I like the pie analogy. You know, as a counselor, you've counseled many people. What do you think is, do you see a pattern of what holds people back?
That's a good question. I think fear. Mm. And people fear different things. And so for some people, it might be fear of what other people think, or other people might be fear of failure, or fear of instability, or fear of the unknown. But I think fear is the thing that keeps us all back. And so I think a lot of my time was spent on challenging that fear to be like, what is that based on? And is that true? Especially when their fear is based on like what could happen in the future. There's risk management and then there's like, you know, then there's just living out of fear. And I think we do the latter more than the former. I remember, I think I've told you this story before, Melissa, but like when I'd finished seminary and I'd finished my master's in counseling as well. And I was working at it as an intern at a church, and I was kind of weighing two different opportunities. One was a little more risky than the other. One was to go back to my hometown and be a hospital chaplain. Another one was to come out to Los Angeles and be a pastor at a church out there or out here. And I remember talking to different people, and I just remember talking to my stepmom, and she said, go to Los Angeles. She's like, because if that doesn't work out, then you can always come home and stay in our basement and figure things out. I know that's the riskier one, but Like if it doesn't happen, then what's, well, you're just going to end up back in your hometown, which is where the other job is anyway. So it's like, why not take that risk? And I think that was so huge to realize that there are very few decisions that can't be undone. I'm trying to think if I have the negatives, but most decisions we have in our lives, we can take back, we can unwind. Which means we need to be very careful about the ones that we can't unwind, like having children, you know, getting married and contracting with another person to have your life bound to theirs. Like those are big decisions that are hard to undo, but or can't be undone. But most things are not like that. Like you can kind of go out, try it, and if you fail, like it's okay. Like there are, like you can unwind that. Mm-hmm. And even as I'm saying that, I recognize that part of that can be a sense of privilege. Like there are a lot of people in this world that maybe that doesn't feel as true for, right? Like, am I, I had parents who had a basement I could stay in, you know, they weren't super wealthy, but they, you know, they had a basement I could stay in. And so I recognize that. And I think we have to, acknowledge that and be grateful for things that we have and make sure that we are there for people who don't have that. And I think that's something that Esther and I have tried to do. Like when there are people and you've seen it. So when there are people who, are trying to weigh out what they're doing in the future, we're like, well, if it doesn't work out, you can come and stay in our back house. You know, like there's, I think that's one way we can, pay it forward is, you know, to help be the safety net for people if they don't have it in their community right now. But
yeah, I mean, and like full disclosure, you know, I was recording a podcast with June and Juliet. I think you remember me, the family I used to nanny for. And yeah. I was telling them it was them, like seeing them and living with you and Esther, and you know, obviously for people who are listening, you know this because I was living with you, but essentially I was homeless, you know, I didn't have anywhere to go, and you and Esther were super generous and let me stay with you guys for free, if I could tell people that, you know. Yeah. And I think for so long I had this I don't know, I'm sure it's the whole psychology behind it, but one of the things I saw was, you know, being successful in the material sense or having wealth, it was a reflection of a negative characteristic about you. And I think also for me personally, it was in that time of my life, I think I did have this very like victim mentality, or someone else is going to help me, or whatever the case might be. But living with you and with June and Juliet, I think for the first time, I just saw the goodness of having those kinds of resources, because while so many friends were kind with their words and those things are important too, I experienced the power of having resources like you and Esther could say, hey, come stay with us. And that was life-saving because I was so low on any form of cash. And it was in that front room, when I was staying in that front room, I have this vivid memory where I just said to myself, I was just like, what am I doing? What am I doing with myself? I'm just here, this whittling my life away. You know, just being around you guys. And I've known this about you guys for so long, because this is just what you guys do, I think, in your everyday lives. But to experience that firsthand from you guys, you know, it really changed. It honestly just like woke me up. And I don't know. I guess I just wanted to, I don't know if I ever told you guys that, but you know, it completely like shifted my point of view and how I live my life, and just saw how good you could be with, you know, having resources, or, you know, I don't know. I just saw the power in it. And it was, I was like, I want to be that person too. If someone ever needed help, like, I can say, hey, here's a few bucks, or come stay with me, have the space. But I'm here being helpless. Like, I need a room to stay in, you know? So yeah, anyways, I don't know why I forgot why I was telling you that story originally, but, so random question though, for many of us, I think in ways we do compare ourselves to others, and we are judgmental of other people as well. And I think for some of us, what we'll do, and I'm guilty of this, we'll look at someone and say, like, why can't this person just get it together? I mean, how would you counsel people like me or others who might be judgy of other people?
Well, full disclosure, I can easily be very judgmental of other people as well. Like, I think, I think that's something we all can be guilty of. I think the goal is always empathy, is to really understand their story enough so that you could put yourself in it to understand, like, why they are exactly where they are. Very few people go through life saying, I'm going to make irrational decision after irrational decision and end up in a completely crazy world. Mm-hmm. They, like, every decision they make makes sense to them at the time. They feel like this is the only choice. This is the best choice available to them at the time. And on the outside, it may not feel that way. It'd be like, you had so many other options. And yeah, I've had so many friends and family members who make choices that I think, like, that's just crazy. Like, why would you do that? That makes no sense whatsoever. But you realize how they got there. It was through a series of small decisions, and they felt trapped, and they felt like that was their best answer. Or they felt like this is the way to get what they want. I've seen people who kind of consistently enter into relationships. Like, this is a woman I knew. She would just consistently enter into relationships that were unhealthy, abusive. And I just remember talking to her, like, why are you doing this? Like, this makes, like, you know, you were in like three of these before. And part of it is just, she did not value herself and did not see her own true worth. And so why would she expect a guy to value her when she's like, doesn't value herself? She's like, oh, he sees me exactly as I see myself, which is worthless. And that was the problem. So that was part of it. And then also part of it is, you know, the things that she had kind of set up in her life of what was the ultimate value. And it was romantic love. That was the ultimate value. And everything else could be sacrificed at the altar of that value. And like, that's something that she had to unlearn. And she did. I think the more we can understand and have compassion on why people end up in the positions they do, that gives us empathy and care. So we're not as dismissive or judgmental of them. So we realize, hey, if I had lived their life, like everything, like the losses they experienced as a child, the decisions they were forced to make, the pain that they've gone through, you know, who's to say I wouldn't have ended up in the same spot? And so then we start to stop thinking of them as crazy or illogical. And then we just be like, wow, like how can I help? And that also gives you the ability to know how to speak into their pain, to be able to say, that's not true. You're not worthless. Be like, that, you know, romantic love is not the only way you're ever going to find acceptance in this world. Like, there are so many people here who love you and care for you. And that is a beautiful piece. And I hope you have that one day, the romantic love, but it's not all you need. And you can't keep sacrificing yourself and everything you value just to try to have this one thing. Mm-hmm. And so empathy, really understanding, like, and that gives you the tools to not be judgmental, but also to speak into it. And that, and then you're more likely to be received well, when you're speaking from empathy. So, that's what I thought of when you asked the question.
That's good. All right. So just to wrap things up. So final question is, what would you tell your younger self?
Yeah, I think I would say, it's going to be okay, and don't be afraid. And yeah, your life is going to be so much better than you ever imagined. Like, I feel like I've been through the ringer, as we've talked about. Like, I've been through a lot of different crises, and we didn't even talk about all of them. But I also feel like I've had really amazing opportunities, and I've been able to see the world and have amazing experiences. So I think it's going to be okay. Don't be afraid. And I think at the moment that you feel like you're losing everything is also the moment that you have to reshape your life into something better. And so I think it's something I'm still learning to this day, of just how to both like fully grieve and be sad for when things are really falling down and falling apart for yourself and so many other people. And to really own that and say, this is really sad and this is bad. But also have the courage and the strength to say, what can I learn from this? How can I grow? And because if you take the time for that, you will grow. That's in fact the only way to grow is to see what happens when things go wrong and then make choices based on that. And I think that's something I'm still trying to practice to this day. And that's what I think my younger self, especially after I was injured, I'm like, you know, you kind of think that life is over, you know, and you can't walk. It wasn't by a long shot.